Now, a century ago this year, bonfires were blazing, not in Australia, but on the hills of Ireland. But it was for a man who was very well known in Australia. The man that they were blazing for was a man named Daniel Mannix. Now, that name might not mean very much to us today, but in Australia, Daniel Mannix, who was Archbishop Mannix, remains one of the most influential and widely known characters in Australian history of the entire 20th century. He's a man who was born in Cork, but he became the Archbishop of Melbourne, and he played no small role in defeating conscription in Australia during World War One, which was something which made him something of a public hero, but he was barred from re-entering Ireland when he tried to come home afterwards. Such was the fear of his political influence, and he was even granted the freedom of the city of New York, even though his name is very little known among Corkonians today. And of course, that sounds like exactly the sort of thing that Donal Fallon should be talking us through in another Hidden Histories. Donal,
I'm not here to talk about the black and tans.
You're not. But before we talk about Daniel Mannix, we sort of kind of have to talk about the black and tans, because listen, there's been so much talk this week, and we've already talked about it with Union Happen earlier in the show. A lot of divisive talk about the past this week. Your general reflection on where we gone.
Yeah, you know, Margaret Thatcher's old joke that the problem with the Irish is you have too much history. 1920 was not merely defined by the black and tans, but it seems the current kind of news cycles are. Mm. But my reflections on this week would be this. I find it really striking that, you know, commemoration ultimately is as much about the contemporary world as it is the past. Mm. And one way that's been reflected, I think, in recent times has been there's a real absence of emphasis on the deeply important place of religion, you know, priests, the Catholic Church, in the lives of so many people in revolutionary Ireland, because that Ireland is so culturally different from the Ireland of today. Mm. And you know, we tend to take what we like from the past and abandon what we don't. But as far as religious leaders are concerned in the period, very few have the influence of Archbishop Daniel Mannix.
Ah, very nice
banned
segue. I see what you've
from entering Ireland in 1920, the year in which the Black and Tans arrived. Bonfires literally blazed in the hills to welcome this man into Ireland, and then eventually in protest at his banning from the country. And Mannix, I mean, if you ask any Australian about Archbishop Mannix, they know him straight away. He spent 46 years as the Archbishop of Melbourne. But it's worth making this point as well at the beginning, that revolutionary Ireland stretches far beyond the island of Ireland. I mean, the Fenians have been formed in New York City, London, Salford, Glasgow, Manchester, you could go on and on and on, are all brimming with kind of young revolutionary Irish men and women on the neighbouring island. And then Australia, I mean, the largest ethnic minority in Melbourne, the Irish, they may have been far away from the front lines of the Irish Revolution, but as we'll learn in this story today, Australia played its own very real significant part. Yeah,
so talk to us then about Daniel Mannix. He was a Corkonian from fairly humble stock.
He was. Now, I think he claimed to be from humbler stock than he was, to be honest, looking into it. It certainly suited his image of himself. Son of a tenant farmer, born in Cork, 1864. And, you know, as a young man, pivotal figure in Maynooth, the National Seminary. And, I mean, he really tries to bring in a harsh conservative regime at Maynooth. I mean, he argues that priests shouldn't be drinking whiskey, they shouldn't be smoking cigars, they should live humble lives. Mm. And then he sent them off to Australia in 1913. Considered quite a conservative figure to have emerged from Maynooth. And 1913 is a time when the world is on the brink of total disaster.
Yeah.
Now, the Irish Down Under formed a massive block of public opinion. I think the numbers are amazing. The 1891 census for Australia, 228,000 Irish-born people. That's not like my granny is from Ireland or my mammy is from Ireland.
That's first generation immigrants,
born on the island of Ireland. 228,000 of us.
And that's even before the 20th century, before travel was that bit much easier.
Exactly.
Like, it's remarkable.
What a journey to go on. And what had once been like a convict destination, where you again went against your own will, had become a place that we voluntarily emigrated to. I mean, there'd been gold rushes in Victoria, and there was labouring opportunities elsewhere. Australia was a young country in its own weird way in these kind of great emerging cities.
But it's funny actually that at the time, you know, back in 1891, it's 19th century communications, but you hear about gold in Ballarat and immediately you have tens of thousands of Irish people going down to see what they can find. It's remarkable. And they went in such numbers that they did make their mark in such a big way when they were there.
They did. I mean, you had the Gaelic League, the Irish language movement, has branches in Melbourne and Sydney. The GAA explodes in Australia. Mm. And by the time of World War One, they estimate that Irish Catholics make up about a quarter of Australia's overall population.
Wow.
And if you go to Melbourne today, I mean, if you walk around the streets of Melbourne, there's this great imposing statue of Daniel O'Connell. You know, the Liberator went up in 1891. So the Irish were really making their mark felt in in Australia. Yeah. And even today, they're still there. I mean, I have cousins in Australia. I think almost everyone listening to this show will have a relation in Australia. Mm. And there's still a very significant GAA presence down under, among other things.
When you mentioned the statue of Daniel O'Connell being there in Melbourne, of course, there's another Irish statue which is outside the Parliament buildings in Sydney, but it's the statue of Queen Victoria, which used to be outside Leinster House, which got transplanted when we decided she no longer was appropriate for our little Parliament Square. Talk to us then about Daniel Mannix and that particular role you mentioned about World War One, which really propelled him into national consciousness.
Australia, like Ireland, had a really bad experience of the First World War. And actually, I would say the Australians had a worse World War One than we did. 60,000 Australians were killed in the conflict. And I think one way in which our experiences were the same is that attempts to introduce conscription into both countries, they failed abysmally. And in the words of Monsignor Curran, who was based in Dublin, he said that outstanding in Australia, the Archbishop of Melbourne, Dr. Mannix, has aroused extraordinary enthusiasm for the Sinn Féin movement among the Irish, earning the equally intense hatred of the imperial element. I mean, he took the platform at these enormous anti-war meetings and he denounces the war as a trade war. He says, you know, all war is economics, and insists that the Irish will be the backbone of any anti-conscription movement that arose in that country.
It's remarkable actually that they had such concerns about it, given that there wasn't still the extra complication of home rule or independence in Australia. They seemed to be relatively happy where they were in the empire, notwithstanding the Irish population that was there. So it's kind of fascinating that they had the same resistance or concerns about being drafted in. They tried to bring conscription in twice.
Yeah, I mean, 1916 and again 1917, they failed both times. And look, I think going to war,
what's Einstein's definition of insanity about repeating the same thing over and over again?
Going to war, I mean, whatever about the moral right and wrong of any war, but actually saying, I am going to fight in this war, it takes tremendous bravery, I think. But being sent to war against your own will, that's a different thing entirely. And the Prime Minister of Australia, Billy Hughes from the Labour Party, he totally misread public opinion. And I mean, both times he goes to the public, he fails. So he was confronted by this kind of remarkable and uneasy coalition. You had radical trade unionists in Australia, the Wobblies, and then you have this conservative Corkonian Archbishop. Yeah. So it's not every day you get, you know, the far left and a Catholic Archbishop lined up side by side. But every attempt at conscription fails. And they say that Mannix, like his ability, his speaking ability, and his ability to influence the Irish vote was at the heart of the failure of conscription.
So having led that campaign then and being to the forefront of this anti-conscription movement, he becomes one of the most famous Irishmen in Australia, perhaps one of the most famous Irishmen in the world. And then he goes to New York. Tell us about
that. Yeah, he's the second most famous Irishman in the world after Eamon de Valera. And again, we read history backwards. I mean, Niall Jordan, the Michael Collins movie makes Michael Collins the hero of the period. But if you're alive in the early 20th century, Michael Collins is someone who's pretty much in the shadow. I mean, the public face of Irish nationalism is Eamon de Valera. Mm. And I suppose just behind him
is... he's a survivor of 1916 and everything
he's
else.
He's speaking all over the United States. He's in Fenway Park and Madison Square Gardens.
He's a statesman,
and he's shaking hands and kissing babies. But just behind him is Archbishop Mannix. He's an international name. I mean, he even makes a film. He has the sense to go, oh, the movies, that's a means of propaganda we need to get on top of. And he makes a film starring himself very modestly called Ireland Will Be Free. And then he travels to America. He shares a platform, Madison Square Gardens. I mean, think about who plays Madison Square Gardens today. I mean, that is, you know, UFC and, you know, major pop concerts. Madison Square Gardens is sold out for Eamon de Valera with the support act of Archbishop Mannix. Then he throws the first ball at the New York Polo Grounds. I mean, that's an honour that's bestowed on celebrity visitors. He gets the freedom of New York City, and then he sets his sights on this triumphant return to Ireland. Unfortunately, the authorities had different plans.
Well, this is it, because you would think that someone then who is so widely celebrated among the Irish expatriate communities and someone who is held up as this public hero in Australia and he's so welcome in New York, and the fact that he's a Catholic Archbishop, you would think that he might be right at home in Ireland of the 1920s. So he sets about leaving New York, coming home. He's just shared a platform with Eamon de Valera and he's coming home, and then he gets some news along the way.
He sails for Queenstown. People are shouting Cove at the radio, Cove today, on board a ship called the Baltic, and he's informed that not only will he be barred from entering Ireland, but the government won't allow the ship to offload him in Glasgow or Liverpool because there's so many Irish people in those cities.
Why?
They think he could cause rioting there too.
What's the issue? Because you'd imagine, you mentioned the bonfires, the people were delighted to see him. Where does it go off the rails?
You think about Ireland in 1920, the auxiliaries, the Black and Tans, the political repression on the ground is so real. This guy Mannix has successfully stopped conscription in Australia. So I think the government have a real fear of his ability. You know, they could whip Ireland, which is already on fire, into a blazing inferno. And the excitement in Ireland's amazing. Bonfire, that's a tradition going back hundreds of years when people arrive back into a village, or even in recent times after a sporting victory.
Yeah, after all, Ireland's got bonfires.
In the GAA, the bonfires go up in the countryside. It's a very powerful, evocative thing to see. And the bonfires are blazing to welcome Mannix Catholics back into Ireland. Even in Dublin, apparently, there are bonfires in city centre streets. But he's barred from entering, from touching Irish soil. And he sees the lighter side of it. He has this great joke. He says, since the Battle of Jutland, the British Navy has not scored any success comparable with the capture without the loss of a single British soldier of the Archbishop of Melbourne. You know, he thinks this is British military might at its best. But it only cemented his reputation. You know, and I think for many people in Ireland, stopping this Irish-born Catholic bishop from stepping foot on Irish soil, it only kind of intensified political feeling.
So he ends up then having to go back to Australia without ever managing to set foot back in his native Ireland again. But he lives a long and pretty happy life.
He gets
there.
Back into Ireland when it's all over. He arrives, I think, in 25 when the whole revolution has passed and he's no longer regarded as a threat. But he lives to 99 years of age, which is an incredible year, an incredible age to reach at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
And they bury him in St. Patrick's Cathedral in Melbourne. And I mean, right up to the end of his life, he's vocal on everything, opposed to racism. He says there's no colour bar in Australia. Tended to support Catholics within the Australian Labour Party, but opposed communism and anything near it. And eventually the Irish community lost influence. You know, all over the world this is true. It's true in New York and it's true in Australia. Other kind of migrant communities would surpass the Irish in time. Mm. But I think it's fair to say, and if you've seen them playing a game of hurling on a beach on a Christmas day, you know, the Irish heritage is still fundamentally important to Australian identity even now.
Yeah, I reckon anyone who's been to Bondi Beach on Christmas Day and counts the amount of Carlo and Leash jerseys that they'll see around the place, they'll know that we're still there in big numbers. Donal, as ever, thank you very much for that really, really intriguing insight into the life of Archbishop Daniel Mannix. Donal is a historian. He's the author of the Come Here to Me books, volumes 1 and 2, and he's the host of the Three Castles Burning podcast, which is available everywhere you get all of your audio listening material.